Welcome to Local Energy Rules, a podcast about people putting together great community renewable energy projects and examining how energy policies help or hurt the development of clean local power. My name is Wade Underwood. This week, John speaks to Joy Hughes, founder of the Solar Gardens Institute in Colorado. Joy talks about the significance of Colorado's solar garden legislation and her continued pursuit of community-based solar policy at the federal, state, and local levels. Here's John and Joy now.
Welcome to the program, Joy.
Thank you, John. It's an honor.
Well, I'm just so glad to talk to you, Joy, because obviously what's gone on in Colorado for community-based energy is a lot more significant than many other places. For folks who aren't familiar, there was a community solar gardens law passed in 2010 and finally rolled out just last year to support the development of community-based solar. Just a couple little details. It was supporting projects smaller than 2 megawatts, but of 10 or more subscribers, as they're called in the law. They had to live in the same county and basically buy no more than they could use themselves. And this legislation really was the first in the country that I know of that really focused on community solar. And I'm curious that, you know, I'm sure that you had much to do with it and was wondering what it is that got you started in working on community solar.
Where I lived until recently was a place called the San Luis Valley of Colorado, which is a high, dry mountain valley. And for those reasons, it just has a tremendous amount of solar potential, far greater than most of the rest of Colorado. And so we were facing some concentrated solar power projects that people thought would have an impact, particularly on the bird life and on the quality of life there. One was a field of these things that looked like radar dishes, and I think that company went out of business. But there was another one, I think, that's still active, which is a 600-foot tower. And so we thought, well, why not just set up solar arrays that can provide power for people in the local community and offset their electric bills? And so what we did was set up the website solargardens.org and just gathered interest there, and that was not just the San Luis Valley, but the whole state of Colorado. And we started to promote this law that was in the process of getting passed. In fact, it did pass. It spent about 2 years in a PUC rulemaking process, which I thought was a little long. but eventually it popped out the other end. We had a couple of the projects that were selected for community solar gardens in Colorado.
So, Joy, were you actually the one who came up with the community solar gardens legislation, or simply one of sort of the more vocal advocates for moving it forward?
No, that was written by Claire Levy. And so she actually wrote that bill in response to some Boulder County citizens who had expressed a need for that. But it certainly went far beyond the needs of that one small group, actually, to much larger arrays, up to 2 megawatts, which is, you know, that's a few acres of panels right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it started to attract a number of what you'd call, you know, large or mid-scale solar project developers to Colorado to compete for the honor of building these projects.
Now, you mentioned it took a couple of years in the rulemaking process, but it finally did roll out late last year. And if I recall from the news stories, the 9-megawatt program was fully subscribed within 30 minutes.
Yeah, it was probably 10 minutes that it took for this to happen. I mean, really, it became a contest of who could type as fast as possible and get a wire transfer in as soon as possible. So It's, unfortunately, it's kind of weighted against something that a small community group can do for themselves. They really need to get themselves an advocate of some kind to who knows the game or knows the ropes. Unfortunately, there's all it gets pretty technical. And the other issue that we're having is that, you know, it's different for every utility. It's different for every state. So there's just a huge maze of rules to navigate.
Given the way that the program was set up and how quickly it was subscribed, it may not have given sort of a fair shake for the kind of real authentic community-based projects you might have hoped that it would. But then also, in terms of the rules being different for different utilities in other states, are there? Does the law require other utilities other than Xcel Energy to launch a program like this? And are you also then working in different states to get such a law passed in other places?
The person we work with most closely is Hannah Masterjohn at Vote Solar. They're an organization that can actually go and do lobbying. So they go and actually work on the text of the bills, and what we do is we help build awareness about them and are sort of a catch basin for the various interest that comes in for these programs. And so we'll find a very excited solar gardener somewhere in one state or another, and they'll actually put legislation in. So, for instance, we have active legislation in California and Washington, in Nebraska, Maryland, and D.C., Hawaii. I think they just tabled theirs in Hawaii, but there's several states that have pulled together legislation for community solar.
In the other states that you're working on, are there tweaks or changes to the law that was passed in Colorado that you're looking to do that will make it more effective when it's implemented in other states?
It's important that some of the things that actually were in the Colorado law get included in some of these other states. And one is the requirement for low income participation. Is that something that that probably won't happen unless it's required, just because a financier is going to go for the lowest hanging fruit first. Trying to keep it to the local community, but then a lot of these small communities really do want to be able to export and to sell power. So we think that keeping half of the subscribers local is a good number, and just for technical reasons on the grid as well, because it allows you to send back about as much power as you're using.
Mm-hmm.
The grid is fairly symmetric in that way. You know, a substation can take in about as much as it can put out. And then, having a preference or a slightly higher incentive for smaller projects, because the larger projects are always going to have more of an economy of scale, and they'll be preferentially used by the financiers. And so you need to cut a little bit higher check to the smaller projects so they actually get built, because that allows you to get the panels a lot closer to your load.
Now, it seems like a lot of these elements that you just mentioned being crucial to the policy in other states are, most of them got included in the Colorado legislation, so it seems like you have a pretty good model then for taking around to other places.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of things that are good in that legislation. I'm trying to think about what sorts of things in Colorado might not have been that great, and sometimes the community groups or the nonprofits would like to retain their renewable energy credits.
So just to clarify, that's the incentive price that goes along with the community solar garden purchase requires the handover of the renewable energy credit to the utility in the Colorado law.
Yeah, that's right. And so in some cases we've seen, the sponsor for the project being a nonprofit, and they actually want to retire these wrecks, which means they're saying, you know, they're going to take the benefit of saying we're using this renewable energy and saving this much carbon, getting the ability to select the projects that are built in a little bit of a better way, for there to be a way of evaluating, is this really a local community project, or is this more of a speculative thing? And then to develop a set of criteria, and we've been working on that at the Solar Gardens Institute. We have the definition of community energy and responsibly built solar power looks like. And so that what we're doing then is trying to promote having the panels as close to the load as possible, having them locally owned, having them built with local labor, financing with crowdfunding, on and on down the list. And of course, no single project has all of those features, but different projects have different subsets of them, and some have more than others.
It's very similar, actually, from my understanding, what they're doing in Ontario. And they've revised their feed-in tariff program is to go to a point system that focuses on some of those local benefits that might not otherwise be considered. So it's interesting to see that also being considered in sort of community solar gardens 2.0.
I think they're definitely ahead of us there in the province of Ontario. And as I understand it, IREC, Interstate Renewable Energy Council, is updating their community solar guidelines. And so the public will have a window of time to participate in what is decided as sort of the gold standard for community solar rules.
I think these are great ideas for how to improve community solar. Are there other kinds of policies or principles that could be applied, other than community solar gardens legislation that would help the development of community solar? Other things that you might be working on?
Yeah, certainly at the federal level, trying to remove the tax equity bottleneck is really important. So to allow for the Sun Act to allow individuals to be able to claim the 30% tax rebate, to restore the 1603 cash grant, be very important, especially for community scale projects, to allow nonprofits to be able to claim some equivalent benefit to the 30% benefit would be really, really valuable. At the state level, to be able to create exemptions in securities laws that would allow local groups to very easily set up a system whereby the benefit from the solar panels is dispersed in some way, whether it's directly on bill or as a credit. I know that some companies have been going the route of doing a securities offering, and the disclosures run to 90 pages. Nobody can really do that without a lot of attorneys. And so if it can be simplified to the point where somebody could do it with maybe, just an attorney there. And also the importance of software that is open source and everybody understands it, and legal documents that are public domain so that anybody can read them for these projects. Get it out into the open, because people are really trying to use this kind of knowledge as a competitive advantage. And, I'd rather see a level playing field for the small players.
You know, if folks are interested in community solar, solar gardens in particular, how they can push ahead with legislation in their town, where do they go to learn more?
You can go to solargardens.org. In particular, the Solar Gardener Training, which is solargardens.org/solar-gardener-training. You can get your project put on the map. We can help find finance for these projects, and we can help organize them and find a subscriber model for you and answer all of your questions.
Well, Joy, thank you so much for being on with me. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best of luck and continue to expand community solar as far and wide as we can see it.
That was John Farrell and Joy Hughes. Joy is the founder of the Solar Gardens Institute, where she continues to advocate for strong locally based energy policy and assist local organizations to develop community-owned solar projects across the United States. For questions or comments, please email jfarrell@ilsr.org with Local Energy Rules Podcast in the subject. John's Twitter handle is John F. Farrell. This podcast was published on May 16th, 2013. Thanks for tuning in.